speak this evening, I told him to find someone else. I think that there are many individuals who are more knowledgeable than I am, certainly more eloquent than I am, and also I gave out to the Kollel today two articles that I thought summed up an approach, at least, in terms of Hashkafa and in terms of Halakha. The article in Hashkafa were from the writings of the Svanama Rebbe Zatzal, the Bala Nesiva Shalom, in which he spoke of the uniqueness of the generation in which we were born, in which we live, and the Hitbonanut, the internal soul searching that a person should go through to try and understand what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants of him in this generation. And the article in Halakha that I gave you gives an overview, precedence for the concept of a yontif, which is created by a community which experiences a miracle. And the frustration that somehow one feels now that we live in a generation that the firmer you are, the less you recognize the miracle. Very, very unusual generation which we live. Just for those who went through the article, to be intellectually honest, one should look in Siman Tav Tzadivav in the Pre-Chadash. There's a huge Pre-Chadash there on the concept of Minhag. And in Seif Yudalit of that Pre-Chadash, he deals with this question of the Minhag of setting up a Yontif. And he brings two dayot as to whether this is something which is binding on individuals, on their children, on their grandchildren. And he, Pre-Chadash himself, views it as something which is an option but not binding. However, the Maram al-Shaker, who's the one who holds that it's binding, he's quoted in the Magen Avraham, in Hilchos Megillah, quoted in the Chayyadam, quoted in the Chasam Sofer, quoted in the Mishnah Brura, as saying that this is part of Minhag. That part of Minhag is that a community looks and for the miracles of each generation, looks into its own community, and has not only the right but the obligation to recognize those miracles. And the minimum of recognizing the miracles, if one goes through all of the Purim Katans that are listed over there, is not to say Tachanun, except in Wayu, not to say Tachanun, to have a Sudat Hodaya, which we're currently experiencing, Baruch Hashem. I hope next year I will not be in Aveilut and I'll be able to participate as I have in past years. To say some form of tefillah to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu, be it Tehillim, be it Halal Mitzri, be it Halal HaGadol. Those are the frameworks of the Purim Katan. So as I said, I didn't want to speak, but I agreed for one reason, actually two reasons. Firstly, Rabbi Olshin asked me, and I can't say no to him. But secondly, because we're dealing with events that occurred 39 years ago, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me the zchut to be an eyewitness of those events. And so I'm speaking to you as an aide, as a witness, to remind us of, I think, that which we should remember, and perhaps to increase, if possible, the Hakoras HaTov that you and I feel towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu for what he's done. So let me take you back, if possible, to June 1967. There was, at that time, a junior in Yeshiva College taking his finals, beginning of June in 67. And so it means that he's about 2 years older than the fellows in Torah Shraga and about 2 years younger than the fellows in the Kollel. So it's not a bad... Not, in other words, I think you could identify with that individual who was me. And I was asked to make a decision that I think that after the decision, I mean, not after chronologically, but in importance, beyond the decision of marrying my wife, which was probably the most important decision in my life, the decision that had the most hashpah on me was the decision that I made at that time, that I'll try and give you the background for it. And just to understand the Chas V'Shalom, I'm not speaking over here that I did something very heroic, probably did something very stupid, but sometimes when one makes a decision, it can really affect one's entire future. The background is that in 1967, Israel was sach hakol young. It was 20 years old, and less than 20 years old, 19 years old, and small. I don't know how I can describe how small and how young Israel was, but the metaphor that was given of David and Goliath, of David and Goliath, was very, very apt. When you got off the plane in Ben Gurion Airport and you wanted to drive to Yerushalayim, there was a highway of one lane in each direction that was on the two sides of it surrounded by Jordan. Namely, that Shalavim was the boundary. Shalavim was the boundary of Eretz Yisrael. Just the other side of Shalavim, there was a Jordanian army post. Many years ago, I heard a story from Rav Nachman Kahana, who lives in the Old City, Rav Meir Kahana, Hashem Yochim Damam's brother, who, I'm not sure if it's a true story or a practical story, but he told a story that when he came on Aliyah, he was driving on the Yerushalayim Tel Aviv highway close to Ben Gurion Airport, and the highway was packed. It was jammed, and he saw a road off to the side that he had never taken before, but he figured it'll take him somewhere. So he went off onto this side road and began driving, and he saw Ben Gurion Airport to his right, and then he was driving, and then he came back to a point where again he saw Ben Gurion Airport to his right, and then he was driving and again he saw it, and he realized he was driving in a circle. And then all of a sudden an army chief came and asked him what he's doing on that road. So he explained that he thought that maybe they'll take him somewhere. So the army individual said, no, this road was built to fool the Jordanian tanks. That if there's a war and the Jordanian tank will go on this road towards Ben Gurion Airport, he's going to keep going around and around in a circle. Because if you let him go straight, he's just going to be in the airport in a minute. And so we built this road that goes in a circle. I'm not sure if it's a true story, but that's how small Israel was at the time. When you think of Yerushalayim and you go to Rechav Shmuel HaNavi, that was the boundary. You weren't able to walk on Rechav Shmuel HaNavi without ducking behind some concrete block which could be shot by a Jordanian sniper who was just on the other side of the street. It was a very, very small country, very, very young, and very, very weak in terms of both manpower, numbers of people, and in terms of what they had at their disposal in terms of weaponry. Masha Ein Kein, the Arabs, as they are now, were very, very plentiful. And there was an individual named Nasser, who was the prime minister of Egypt, who created what he called the United Arab Republic. Namely, he took all of the countries around Israel, from Jordan through Syria, from Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, and Egypt, including Kuwait and Iraq, and it was a broader boundary, and put them all under his military supervision to the degree that it was called UAR, the United Arab Republic. This United Arab Republic decided that it's time to fight Israel and push the Jews into the sea. And they announced it, if they obey, that we are going to push the Jews into the sea. And the world was quiet, so he decided to test the water, literally. And he put a blockade on the Straits of Tiran, namely that no boat could come to Eilat, and the world was quiet. This is sach hakol 25 years after the Shoah. And the world said nothing. So it was go. It was all green light. He said what he's going to do. He began doing it. And then he told the UN, please leave the area. And they left the area. And it was a very, very frightening situation. You would sit in New York and watch TV, which we all did at the time. This was 39 years ago, right? We all watched TV. And 39 years ago, when you watched TV, you would see the news every night, and you would see the Arabs simply marching and marching towards Eretz Israel, bringing more and more and more troops, and saying, we're going to throw the Jews into the sea. So at that time, in Israel itself, there was naturally a sense of doom. People began sort of leaving surreptitiously. There was a black humor at the time that said that the last one out of Israel should turn off the lights. Because of course the sense is just like there's nothing really that's going to keep us here. The foreign students who were here, who were not that great in number, many of them either went back to America or went to Switzerland to learn in Lucerne. It was a quieter place. And people began to look around and see what's going on over here. The Chevra Kadisha was told to prepare mass graves in Tel Aviv and in Yerushalayim, so the park at Gan HaAtzmaut was just dug up in case it would be impossible to get to Har HaMenuchot, to be able to bury people in Gan HaAtzmaut. That was simply the mitzius of what was going on in April and May of 67. And then there was a total gius, a total conscription. Every individual that was able to, between the ages of 18 and 65, was put into the army, and so there were simply no men on the street. In other words, that either you were a yeshiva bachur who was sitting and learning, or you were in the army. The mail was delivered by high school kids. My wife at that time was in high school. She was delivering mail. The buses were being run by retirees over 65. It wasn't the safest place to be. But there were very few people really to go on the buses as well. And the entire economy basically went into a spiral because there was no workforce. Everyone was drafted. There were no foreign workers at the time. And so they sent a call out for money and for bodies and for people to come. That at least on the kibbutzim, all the crops were rotting. There was no one that was able to work. That people should come to fill the spots of the people who were in the army. That was the situation. And I have this little news clipping, which is getting yellow, from the New York Times towards the end of May 1967. 38 U.S. Jews off to Israel to help. It sounds funny, like 38 U.S. Jews, right? Among them, there were four religious Jews. Two of us were from YU, two girls from Stern, and like we were going to save Israel. So, I mean, like, it's a little silly, but aside from that, they also had a $200 million campaign. So we were a part of the campaign, showing that we were willing to go commit Harry Carey. And, you know, it's from my side, it wasn't really, again, it wasn't an act of heroism, because when I'm your age, you don't think about death. Like, it's not something which is on your agenda. But what I did think about was that I had heard a shiur from Rav Lichtenstein. And Rav Lichtenstein at the time, I think he's repeated a number of times, gave a mashal for modern Jewish history in which there is a playing field and a grandstand. And Eretz Yisrael is the field, and the Galut is the grandstand. So you have to make a decision, do you want to be a player or do you want to be a spectator? That was his mashal. It hit that very, very deep, right? In other words, that I thought about it, and I figured that really I should be a player as opposed to a spectator. That was my whole cheshbon in terms of coming to Eretz Yisrael. I should be a player instead of a spectator. So, and also I was able to get out of one of my college exams that I hadn't yet taken. So I told my professor I was going to Israel. But the act of heroism really was taken by my parents. Because we're four children in the family. Two girls who are girls. And two boys who are boys. Right? And two boys, I'm the Bechor, and I have a younger brother who currently lives in Yir HaKodesh Tinek. And my brother was learning in Karen B'Yavne. And when all of his friends were going home, he called my parents, which was a very unusual occurrence, because you usually only call your parents either when there's a death or a birth. But he called my parents to ask permission to remain in Eretz Israel, and they gave it to him. And now I'm telling them, I want to go to Israel as well. Right? That's two for two. That means that all of their sons are going to be in this place which is going to be pushed into the ocean. Mela, my brother, but me. In other words, I'm the Bechor. So it was. I think on their part, in other words, I didn't really expect. I sort of hoped that they would say yes, but I would have understood had they said, "Well, we'd like to remain with one son." He's there already. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yazor, but you're here, and so why should we send you there? So they agreed that I could go on one condition, that my grandparents would not know about it. That was the only thing. I wasn't allowed to tell my grandparents, because they felt that that would be the end of my grandparents. And so I went to the Rav, at the time I was in the Rav Shir, to say goodbye. And he was the first one who really sort of brought me into the realm of reality. He began to cry. And he said, you know, I have one son, and he's in Eretz Israel. Chaim Soloveitchik at the time was in Yerushalayim. He was studying at Hebrew University. I have one son, and he's in Eretz Yisrael. And do me a favor, if you could find my son, tell him that I love him, and that I doubt him for the best. So I figured, why is he crying? He's crying like he's saying goodbye to me, and he's never going to see me again in his life. And then I realized that it was like really something that was a little more serious than just being a player on a field. But the reason that I am currently in Eretz Yisrael, I would say, is because I made that decision. Namely, that after having been in Eretz Yisrael at that time, it was only a question of when I was going to return. It wasn't a question of where or what or whether. It was only a question of when. And who I didn't, when I look at the names of the people who are here, that I really haven't looked at for quite a long time, most of them are in Eretz Yisrael. It's very, very... Baruch Hu has a very good sense of humor, that the one who's supposed to speak tonight, Benji Levine, he was on the plane with me as well. But he was asked to speak elsewhere because he's a much better speaker, and so he was asked earlier. But he was on the plane as well. And he also, at that time, sort of made the decision to come back. And so HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me the zchut to, as I mentioned, to be a witness to the nisim v'niflaos in the field, on the playing field, rather than in the grandstand. And I won't bore you with my war stories. There aren't really. I was in kibbutz. I was on kibbutz Yavne. Benji Levine, he was the frum one. He went to Chafetz Chaim. But I went to Yavne, but not because I wasn't that frum, even though I really wasn't that frum, but because I had a brother in Kerem Yavne, and I figured that way maybe, I had no idea where kibbutz Yavne was, because it was the same name. They couldn't be that far from one another. And really, they were on the other side of the chicken coops, right? There's kibbutz Yavne, chicken coops, and Kerem Yavne. And so that's how I got to kibbutz Yavne. So my adventures were in terms of, trying to lift a bale of hay and have it fall on your head and trying to clean out a refet. All the important things you do in a kibbutz, because there was no one to do them. And so they said, oh, you Americans, you know how to do all these things. You do them. And, okay, I did them. But there were certain things that did stick out of my mind. And here I just want to be serious for a minute, that the war broke out on Monday morning. Monday morning there was a surprise attack, as you all know, on the Egyptian and all the Arab air forces, and they were like wiped out. But no one knew it in Israel that we had won the war. In other words, we were getting all the news reports from the Arab countries and from the BBC, and according to them, Tel Aviv was being bombed, and we were, and the artillery, the Egyptians were advancing from Gaza, etc. And it was very, very frightening. It was really a sense that the scenario that we had feared is really happening. And there were air raid sirens, and there was this, and there was that. So on Tuesday morning, we had a sense that things were not all that bad. But we really had no idea. And so in davening, we said, Oz Yashir, kaka, pasuk by pasuk. Then by the time Wednesday morning came along, we already knew that we won the war. So we, it moved from a tremendous sense of saying Oz Yashir, pasuk by pasuk, because it's a Shira Tayyam, it's a Shir Amanis. And then when we heard, it's there in kibbutzim, there's always a break in the afternoon where you sit with your feet up. So when we were sitting with our feet up in the afternoon, that's when we heard that Rav Gorin was at the Kotel in Har HaBayit Bidenu. And then we were all called to the shul to say hallel with a bracha in the middle of the afternoon. In the middle of an afternoon, on Wednesday, the Shir of Yom, Kilna Kamot Hashem, we went and we said hallel with a bracha with a sense of mimavas l'chayim, that it was really a sense. The first thing we did when we got to the kibbutz, I mentioned the Chevra Kadisha, when we got to the kibbutz, we were told to dig a trench in front of our barracks, in front of our hut where we were sleeping, that if there was an air raid siren, we were supposed to jump into there in the middle of the night, into that trench. It was a sense of digging a grave. And then the air raid siren went off the first night that we were there, because a fellow in Kerem Yavne who was in charge of the air raid siren, he fell asleep, and his elbow hit the siren, and everyone went jumping. Because we were lazy, we didn't dig deep enough, we all fell on one another, but it was a frightening feeling of sort of jumping into a grave, into an open grave. And so from jumping into an open grave to be able to say hallel with a bracha was a tremendous sense of being involved in a One really had that sense that just the whole world turned around within minutes, and you who were in the grave all of a sudden is now saying Hallel. So that was one aspect of the Nes. But there was another aspect of the Nes as well, which is amazing how HaKadosh Baruch Hu does Nisim v'Niflaos. He doesn't just take you from minus to zero, right? Take you from Maves to Chayim. I guess Chayim is a little more than zero, but just to be living. But he moves you up from minus to a plus. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a gift. He gave us a gift of a good part of Eretz Yisrael, starting, of course, with the Kotel, but moving into Kever Rachel and into Marat HaMachpelah and Kever Yosef in Shlem and the entire area of Yehuda v'Shomron, a gift. And it was a sense of Hayinu Kacholmim. You have to understand that I was brought up that the Kotel was something that you saw from afar. You didn't actually even see it. I visited Eretz Yisrael for the first time in 1960. 1960, my parents took my brother and I to Eretz Yisrael, and on Tisha B'Av, during the summer of 1960, we davened on Har Tzion, on the Domitian Abbey, on the roof. Because that was the place where you could, with binoculars, look down and say, beneath that area, that's where the Kotel is. And so it was like the closest you could get to the Kotel was being on Har Tzion and knowing that the Kotel is not all that far from you, but you can't even see it. It's beneath, it's just beneath something. And then you knew the Kotel was over there. But even then, when you're on the Domitian Abbey, you had to be behind a concrete plaque, at least an Arab, beside, to take a pot shot at you when you were trying to daven mincha on Tisha B'Av in the afternoon. And so to move from that status, all of a sudden, in hours, to be able to walk, to be able to feel that one can get to the Kotel, it was mamash a feeling of Hayinu Kecholmim, that just, you couldn't believe that it was really happening. Like you're in a dream world, and it's real. And just one more event I just want to share with you, because it probably was the most meaningful day, again, aside from my marriage day, in my life. And that's the day, that was Chag HaShavuot. That was Chag HaShavuot in June 1967. It was Sach HaKol a few days after the Six-Day War. This is Kaf Chet. And next week, in other words, Sach HaKol, a little more than a week is going to be Shavuot. And Shavuot was the first day that the Kotel was opened to Amcha, that was opened to the Jewish people. Immediately, the day on that Wednesday, so Rav Gorin went and he took the Nazir to the Kotel. The Rav David Kohn, the Talmud Chaver of Rav Kook, had made a number of Nedarim, but one of them was in 1948 that he wasn't going to leave his house until he could go back to the Kotel. So for 19 years he was in his house, and then Rav Gorin got permission to take him to the Kotel, and that way he was able to leave his house. 19 years he was in his house because he wanted to go back to the Kotel. Most of us were not in that plane. We didn't get to the Kotel on Kaf Chet B'Iyar. However, on Yom Yerushalayim, on Chag HaShavuot, Arab Shavuot, they knocked down all the Arab houses that were in front of the Kotel. No one bothered to ask permission. There was no sin, Baruch Hashem. Just knocked it all down. And all of Yerushalayim went to the Kotel. In other words, how did I get to Yerushalayim? With Kerem Yavne. And with Kerem Yavne, the whole yeshiva came to Yerushalayim. We daven Shacharis in Heichal Shlomo. We had a Kerem Yavne minyan in Heichal Shlomo. And heard Kriyas HaTorah. And then from Musaf, we decided to go to the Kotel. And there was just a stream. I mean, those of you who have been here in the past and have gone to the Kotel on Shavuot morning towards Vasikin, you know what a trickle is. I'm talking about a trickle. I'm talking about a stream. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people, all of Yerushalayim, and all the people who came from outside of Yerushalayim were on their way, and it was all turned into a one-way street. Namely, you went and you walked up the Har Tzion. There was a road. Kadosh Baruch Hu really has a sense of humor. A road that was built for the Pope. The Pope once came to visit, and so they built a road for the Pope to go from Israel to Jordan, up Har Tzion. So on the Pope's road, that's where all of the Jews went up towards Yerushalayim, towards the area of the Kotel of Har Habayit. Everyone up that way went into Shaar Tzion, down into through Shaar HaAshpot, to the area that was totally dusty. There was no pavement. It was just rubble that we were walking on. Davened at the Kotel, and then back through the Shuk to Shaar Yafa. That was the way everyone, you couldn't go, there was no two-way traffic. It was only one way around. And it was the most beautiful, beautiful day just to be with Klal Yisrael at a point where after 19 years, one has a sense of, I don't want to use the word Ikvus Ad Meshicha because it's been used too often, but there's a sense that one has moved over into a different point within Jewish history. Just to give you the sense of the feeling, in Yavne, when we returned to Yavne, they had a vote as to whether we should fast on Shavuos or B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av. They had a vote as to whether we've moved over into a Tekufa where these turn into Yemei Simcha. So only in the kibbutz you have a vote, otherwise you're rubbing sides. So the vote was that Shavuos or B'Tammuz, that they voted not to fast, and Tisha B'Av, they left it up to the individuals. Those who wanted to fast could fast. Those who didn't want, they were too young on Tisha B'Av. Okay, but just to understand that wouldn't go now. It's just like what are you talking about? I mean, we're people blowing themselves up all the time, and you know, it's just now we've sort of settled into the reality. But then it was really like living a dream. And this is something that is real. Now, I'm telling you what I saw. Not what I heard, not what I saw on TV, but what I experienced. And it's something very, very special, a tremendous gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to me. But I'd like to leave you, if possible, with three messages. One message is that in life, you're all going to have to make decisions. And you should realize that there are silly decisions, like whether to eat schnitzel or chicken. That's like a silly decision. Even a silly decision to think about ordering meat, right? But that's, you know, there are decisions and silly decisions and sillier decisions. But there are real decisions that one has to make in life. And one has to realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us all of the opportunities. All the opportunities HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us. He loves us, he gives us all the opportunities. We just have to make the right decisions. The right decision for person A is not to say the right decision for person B, but a person has to realize that the results of his decisions many times can be mitgalgel into where he's going to be headed all of life. These are decisions that fellows in Torah Shraga have to make in terms of where they're going to go to college or where they're going to continue learning or etc., etc. These are decisions that fellows in the Kogel have to make that we discussed during the course of the year that I really don't want to talk about now. But there are real decisions that people have to make in terms of their lives. Secondly, in terms of Eretz Yisrael, you have a much more difficult challenge, in my humble opinion, than my generation had. There's a very well-known Gemara in Suvas on Daf Ayin Hey Yomad Aleph. The Gemara quotes a pasuk, U'litzion yeyomer ish ish yuladba v'hu yechonaneha el yom. And the Gemara says, Rav Maisha bar barte de Rav Yeshua ben Levi, he understood, Echod ha-novadba ve-echod ha-betzapel l'rosa. Namely, that Tzion has two kinds of children. He has children who yearn for Tzion, and he has children who were born in Tzion. Ish-ish, yuladba. That these are both children of Tzion. So my generation, I view it, was a generation of Echod ha-betzapel l'rosa. It was a generation in which people yearned for Tzion. It was all a dream. It was nothing that was real. It was nothing that was concrete. You had to really want something that we daven about, but what is not there. And so when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the beautiful, beautiful gift that he gave us, I think we all appreciated it tremendously. Your generation is a generation of Echad HaNoladba. And Noladba doesn't necessarily mean someone who was born in Eretz Yisrael, in my humble opinion. Noladba means someone who was born with Eretz Yisrael. Someone who was born that Eretz Yisrael is here. It's already part of your lives. It's already something that maybe when you were little kids, your parents may have brought you here for Yantef, or something that was always part and parcel of your reality. Not part of your dreams, but part of your reality. To view a reality as a dream, to yearn for a reality, is much more difficult than yearning for a dream. It's much more difficult because it's sort of taken for granted. And then you find all sorts of faults. You see, in my generation, we didn't find faults because when you're given such a gift, so what if it's a little chipped on the side? But it's a tremendous gift. But if it's your car and it's chipped on the side, why do I have a chip on the side of my car? I'll sell it and get another one. Or, you know, where it's etc. You know, it's something that you don't, you just take the essence for granted, and then you see unfortunately, all of the problems, and there are problems, but it depends on what perspective one is able to see those problems. So your challenge, my humble opinion, is A, to make proper decisions, B, to view Eretz Yisrael as a gift that was given to your generation that hadn't been given to your grandparents' generation and your great-grandparents' generation. For thousands upon thousands of years, Jews were living without this gift in their pocket. And here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave this to you. He created you in a world where you are the luckiest people in the world to be able to sit and learn in Yerushalayim. Do you know what your great-grandfather would have given to learn in Yerushalayim, to sit and learn in Yerushalayim? And it's mind-boggling when one thinks about it. You know, it's how this was something that was, when Mashiach comes, that's when we're going to do that. That's a different realm, a different era altogether. And here, you know, our question is, well, you know, like, where to learn, or how to learn, or when to go, when to come, v'chulei v'chulei. The final message that I'd like to leave you with is in terms of Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim to us is a symbol, not just a city, it's a symbol. It's a symbol, of course, of Mikdash, that this is the center, this is from the world was created from here, this is Adam HaRisham, this is Avraham and Yitzchak, this is the Makom HaShchina, this is the Makar of all Kedusha in the world of Makom comes from the Beis Kodshei HaKadoshim. Yerushalayim is Mikdash, and Yerushalayim is Malchus Beis David, Semach David Avdecha, Bonei Yerushalayim. That Malchus Beis David is with Yerushalayim, a return to being an Am with a Melech and Kohen Gadol. All of that is with Yerushalayim. Fascinatingly, the Sphira of Kafchet Be'iyar is Chesed Sheba Malchus. Such a fitting Sphira. Chesed Sheba Malchus. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a Chesed to be able to taste a little bit of maybe what Malchus is going towards. But in terms of those two symbols, I think that our hishtadlus is one of tefillah. We're mispalel for Binyan Beis HaMikdash. We're mispalel for Malchus Beis David. But there's a third symbol of Yerushalayim as well. The Gemara in Baba Kama, Daf Pei Beis, Amid Beis, tells us that Yerushalayim could never become an Ir Nidachat. If a niftar was found out of Yerushalayim, there would be no Egla Arufa going towards Yerushalayim. Because those dinim apply to a city which is part of a shevet. And Yerushalayim is above that. It's above Shvatim. You look at the last parak of Yechezkel when he talks about Yerushalayim, he speaks about Yerushalayim as being a square with 12 gates, three on each side. Every gate was the gate of a different shevet. This is Shaar Shimon, and this is Shaar Yehuda, and this is Shaar Binyamin. But once you go through that gate, that's it. There are no longer any Shvatim. There's just Klal Yisrael. Just one aspect of Klal Yisrael. It all merges. And in this area, I think that we can do more than be mispalel. I think that this is something that we have a geder hishtadlus because it's a question of a perspective. It's a question of how do we view? Are we able to rise above? Are we able to have a sense of Klal Yisrael? Are we able to get out of the box? Are we able to break down divisions? Are we able to see a Jew and feel we'd like to hug him because he's our brother, and even though he looks different from us, may speak differently from us, but he's really part of us, that we're part of him, and we all ultimately have one neshama, one nishmas Klal Yisrael. That's what's symbolized very, very much by Yerushalayim. And so I think that this is something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the symbol, and now it's for us to put in the content. Try as much as we can. So in those areas where our hishtadlus is tefillah, so tefillah. In our areas where our hishtadlus can be, just changing things even within our Dalet Amos, changing things within the Beis Medrash, changing things within the yeshiva, changing things within our neighborhood. That's something that a person should think about in terms of Yom Yerushalayim, in terms of being able to really feel that sense of Klal Yisrael. So I want to end off just with the tefillah. Uvnei Yerushalayim ircha b'mehera v'ha'aleinu l'socha and amyirtz Hashem b'samcheinu b'vinyana. Amen.